to the solid-state system, which has great coherence. Okay, but still the Hamiltonians, actually, we can't describe with as much clarity as what we can do in the NV system, because of course there are lots of degrees of freedom. You know, in the neutron interferometry case, there really are very few degrees of freedom. There's the two paths in the neutron spin. And so we don't have to neglect much. But in the NV case, of course, we're embedded in a diamond. And so, you know, we haven't talked about, oh, this is the band structure of the diamond and such things. We're not going to talk about that. So we end up in these solid-state systems saying, oh, we'll take an approximation of the Hamiltonian. You know, we'll show that this approximation is a good approximation. Pretty much we show that experimentally. And then there's some pieces that we need to keep track of. You know, it says, oh, we have all these terms in the Hamiltonian. You know, that we'll find that there are terms about the axis about which the system's quantized. There's terms in frequency terms and the hyperfine interaction and in other pieces. And we'll say, yeah, we know those pretty well. But we won't know those exactly. And part of the what quantum information science brings to the picture is it says, in fact, you can get very good control without having to know those exactly. You simply need to know that they're going to appear within a range. And in fact, I don't even have to specify the entire Hilbert space exactly. I simply need to know that I can live in this separable piece of Hilbert space. So let's review where we are. And I'm going to keep sort of the tone of what we did yesterday. So yesterday we went through and showed things in pretty broad strokes. Now today we're going to fill in some of those details. Then we're going to introduce some other things in broad strokes. And then tomorrow we're going to fill in some of those details. Okay, because I want to give you the big picture before going into details on a particular Hamiltonian. Otherwise, you can get lost as to where you're going, right? So we'll keep doing that. All right, so we've got the solid-state system, and the first piece, which actually we've said enough about, is that by using confocal microscopy, we can focus down on one microscopic quantum system. This leads us to taking the diamond, which has thousands of these defects, and we say, okay, we're just going to look at one. So we have one small microscopic quantum system. And there's a lot of interesting science in confocal microscopy, but the only piece we need about it is to say, we can make the sensitive volume small enough that statistically we only have one quantum system in there. And remember that we saw that we could test that we could use the Henbury-Brown twist experiment to probe if there really is only one quantum system. So since we have an experimental approach to looking at that, we can say, yes, absolutely, we know it's one. Okay. And then we looked at the physics of having this effective, let me put that word there, spin one electron. And we saw that this came out of the exchange interaction. So we had a Hamiltonian and I should put the frequency there. We'll label them as two different spins and we say, this piece here, if it's coupling two electrons or to any spin one half particles, and if this is the only Hamiltonian, it will force the system into the singlet and triplet manifolds. Okay. And remember that this is easier to see if we write it in terms of raising and lowering operators, so that, of course, the anti-aligned states, you know, the state up and down, gets rotated into down and up. And these things move back and forth, rotate back and forth under this interaction. And so it takes and it removes any difference between these two spins. So it really does do an exchange. And the nicest way to think about it is it's an exchange of the label. Okay? So it makes A and B indistinguishable. And of course, in your quantum mechanics courses, you know, they've talked about once you have indistinguishable particles that you need to take a symmetric set of wave functions over that indistinguishability. But even if you don't know that, if you just apply the physics, it comes out automatically, right? Nature demands that of you. So the eigenstructures of this, of course, show that directly. And so we end up, instead of having this four-level system, like so, we apply the exchange operator, and we end up I should put square roots of 2, and I should put brackets, but let's just leave them as labels. We have the whole thing here. Now, remember that in this piece over here, I've left in another Hamiltonian that says, that the energy of the spin matters, right? So this so-called Zeeman Hamiltonian so that this is pulled down in energy and this is pushed up in energy, right? Without this term, take Hz to 0, we end up in this manifold. So Ms equals 0 is this state. And then minus 1 and plus 1, right? So we say, oh yes, this is Ms equal to plus 1. Ms is equal to 0. Ms is equal to minus 1. And this is the singlet state that we're leaving off by itself. And so we end up over here having these degenerate states of plus and minus 1 and the singlet state sitting over here. Yep. Yeah. It better be. Thanks. Okay. So now we have this piece. And this, you know, it takes a little bit of looking at to get used to these things. And for your homework problem, what I want you to do is to take this energy level diagram that we talked about last class. Where we have a Hamiltonian that looks like delta omega sigma z a minus sigma z b plus omega e. We're going to make that time dependent, sigma x plus sigma y and over here, this is the singlet state, and this is the triplet state. And we'll call it the triplet with zero, usually put over here, and the singlet with zero, just to say those are the MS equals zero states, as defined over here, right? So we relabel this yet again. And of course, that's the singlet, and that's the triplet with zero. And the reason we have the splitting here is that splitting has an amplitude of delta omega. That's mixing the energy levels. It says, oh yes, when omega e is equal to zero, this picture over here is the right one. Okay, so that the MZ quantum numbers are good quantum numbers, and everything is fine. We're over here. But when I take omega E to be larger than delta omega, then this is the right basis. And now then I have to think about the system as quantized in terms of these more complicated states, the symmetric state and the anti-symmetric state. And that's what we see here. Okay. And what I want you to do is to start here. Start somewhere over here. It doesn't matter where. So choose this as an initial state. Choose this as your initial Hamiltonian. And then with a constant velocity, change omega e. So we're going to say that omega e of time is equal to some initial value plus some simple linear change. And go over here somewhere, go away from the zero crossing, go through the zero crossing, and then plot out at the end the probabilities that you're in these two states. So what you need to do, of course, is just integrate Schrodinger's equation over that. And as you integrate Schrodinger's equation, you'll see when you do the integral that it's important you take small time steps, right? Take two big time steps, you're not going to see a nice result. But if you take small time steps, you'll see that depending upon the value of that slope, so if we plot d omega e dt versus the probability of ending up in here, T0 probability. Well, if I go really slow, I'm never going to end up there. If I go really fast, I'll end up there. So we know that if we're going really slow, this is going to be 0. If I go really fast, it's going to be 1. And you're going to show me what it looks like in between. Okay? So you have to do it numerically. It's perfectly possible to do it analytically, but there's no reason for it to do it analytically today. Just do it numerically. Okay, we're over here. We've got this piece that says, yes, I have these energy level diagrams. And remember what happened with the NV system. There's a very important piece of physics. I'll put it over here. That we have an electron excitation. It's a lot of energy. It's 520 nanometers. So I can go from ms equals 0 to ms equals 0 here. And if I do that, it cycles. It always falls down. If I go from one of the ms equals plus or minus 1s to its corresponding one, it cycles, but not always. One-third of the time, it has this inner system crossing, which then falls down and then falls down, ends up in the zero state. And remember that these pieces are what allows us to both prepare the state and to measure it. We can prepare because we turn on the light, and if we're up here, we always end up, if we start in zero, we always end up in zero. If we're in the plus minus one, we eventually end up in zero. So I can say, turn on the light, I will someday get to zero, and then I can stop. Or if I'm making a measurement, then if I turn on the light and I'm in this state, I'll get out a range of photons. If I'm in this state, I'll get out less photons because occasionally it will take this other pathway. And these photons will never reach our detector. Okay? So this piece of physics is essential. And we notice something that from the ms equals plus and minus 1, we can transition into these singlet states. But from the ms equals 0 state, we can't transition. So I want to look at that physics. It's a simple enough thing to do. And all we need to do is measure, is calculate a transition probability. So you know, let's do the simple thing. Let's say that I want to know what the transition probability of going from the ms equals 0 state to the singlet state. I keep doing that. And if we're going to use Fermi's golden rule, we need to know what's the operator that's going to allow this. And the operator that we want is to ask, is it dipole allowed? And so the operator says that you're allowed to flip one spin, right? So it's a dipole allowed operator, allowed to flip one spin. Don't flip two, you can only get to flip one. Okay, and you'll remember that Fermi's golden rule says that the transition probability is going to be given x. By this inner product. Okay, so we have a transition probability. So I just need to calculate that inner product. And, well, this is pretty simple. So we're going to flip one spin. Well, clearly, this state, if I flip the first spin, doesn't overlap that one. Right? So if you write it out, and we'll write it out once in gory detail.
and then we won't do it anymore like that. All right. And let me just forget all the normalizations and even forget that we're taking the square of the system. Because if I come up with zero, you'll believe me that if I square zero, it's still zero. Okay, we have those four terms, if I haven't made too many mistakes. And of course, this one goes to zero, because we would flip that, so we'd have down, down. This one, hey, goes to minus one, so life is good, so we get minus one here. But this one goes to plus one, and this goes to zero, and so the answer is that we're not allowed to have a transition between the ms equals plus 1 and the singlet state. And I said, oh, no, a third of the time it goes there. Well, that means it's weakly allowed, but it's forbidden if I just had this simple dynamics. Okay? So yes, it's appropriately forbidden. Now, let's look at what happens. Same physics. And let me get rid of this. We look over here. Why is this forbidden? It's forbidden because these two terms exactly cancel out. Okay? Now we say, oh, no. It's weakly allowed. So I need to modify my transition probability. We're going to modify the transition probability. To say, those two electrons are not exactly the same. And what happens in the crystal is some phonon mode distinguishes those two. And unfortunately, without talking in detail about the structure of diamond, I can't tell you exactly why the phonon modes do this. Okay, I could give you some simplistic arguments. But in fact, it's enough to say, hey, this is the form of the Hamiltonian because the two electrons are slightly different. Okay? And of course, are they slightly different? Sure. This term really does exist in the Hamiltonian. Okay? So already this term makes them slightly different. Good. Now, I apply this argument in here. And immediately you see some nice things. You say, well, no, this is not 1, right? This term becomes minus alpha, and this term becomes plus beta. So the transition probability is going to come in as the modulus of this. We say, oh, yeah, life is good. Now we see something that's allowed, okay? It's only weakly allowed because it's allowed to the extent that the two spins are different. All right. Now then, we come over here and say, what happens between these two cases? What happens between the MS equals zero case of the triplet manifold and the MS equals zero of the singlet manifold? Okay? So we apply Fermi's golden rule again. So we say, can T0 connect to S0? And we have the case and we go ahead and use this more general operator. And of course, we should square the whole thing.
Now look at what happens. This is a different piece. That we could expand it out, and there'll be lots and lots of terms. But I just take some random term. It doesn't matter to me at this point which one I take. Either in expanding out this inner product, either I'm going to have a term where the bra and the ket correspond to two spin flips, or I'm going to have a bra and a ket that corresponds to zero spin flips. Right? There's never going to be a case here. There's no opportunities of having something that corresponds to one spin flip. Okay? So because they're all anti-aligned, then either they're the same or they're different in both spins. And so as I expand this out, every term is zero. Every term is uniquely zero, and it doesn't make any difference what alpha and beta are. This will always be zero. Yeah? So, this transition, it's not allowed, but it's weakly allowed. This transition is not allowed, and it's not weakly allowed. Okay? So the only transitions we can have are this one. Yeah? All right. You get it? Good. Now, there's an embarrassing part of my picture. I never like to hide things from you. You say, oh, look, you've got this thing here, which is a transition that would be the same as this one, right? Except it's going, you know, in the other direction. In Fermi's golden rule, it doesn't matter which way you put the states. You say, oh, no, this must be zero. And it is. Except we don't really know what's going on down here. There's a bunch of other states. And that's the drag of being in the solid state. To say, yeah, well, it really does get here. This picture here is too simplistic to capture all the physics. So I've got the physics captured completely up here. I don't have the physics captured completely down there. So you'll have to forgive me for that. Therefore, when you look in the literature, you'll find some people draw it like this, some people draw it like this, some people put in a gibberish of fictional states down there. We do know that, in fact, this transition takes place. And I do know, in fact, it gets from here to here. I don't imagine, actually, it is a direct process like we've drawn. It must be some other states stuck in there somewhere. Okay? So, good. Okay. So now then, we're convinced that we have most of what we need. And before we go away from this, I want to talk about one more piece of physics. Here, effectively, you know, let's look here. Here, effectively, we have an exchange operation that brings some dynamics. And so we say, oh, no, we're going to define the system in the Zeeman basis, and I'm going to provide something that leads to exchange. And exchange happens all the time. We saw that, actually, in the neutron interferometer, that when we twisted it and we created this crossing of the paths, we could say that we gave a pi pulse and that we had exchange there too. And it's worth spending a couple of seconds looking at the general problem of exchange. So this is a bit of a digression, and we'll get back to that. But we're going to look at exchange. And we're going to look at exchange of two spin 1/2 particles. And because they're spin 1/2 particles, we get a complete description by just looking at the Bloch equations. So here's my system.
I've got some system, we'll call it A, that goes to some system B. And you'll have a rate constant that takes you between those two. And the nicest way of thinking about this is that you have some chemistry that is changing. So in this system, you could think that an electron is moving between sites. Here, we can think about it as having this particular molecule as an example, and probably no one here admits to remembering it in chemistry, but that's okay. I'll tell you that this piece here, this double bond, becomes a partial double bond here. So normally you think about, you have a single bond, you think that the system is free to rotate. But because there's a double bond there, it's actually not free to rotate. But it is free to make 180 degree jumps. And this proton is different than that one, because this one's closer to the carbonyl, and of course there's a lot of electron density there, and this one's further away. Okay, so if I looked at this system, what I would see if I could look at it on a single molecule layer level is that this would occasionally jump. Okay, so let's write down the Bloch equations. So the Bloch equations say that yeah, I'll write it down like this. Yeah.
Why should that be a double bond? Because oxygen has only two bonds, and if it's double, then it's easy.
Yeah. So that's what it is. It is, you know, remember that's this idea that says bonds exist between two atoms is a fiction, right? Bonds are molecular orbitals that extend over the molecule. And so the way this works is because you have a lone electron, you have an electron pair here, we have electron pairs here, we hybridize those orbitals and they appear like this. So exactly as you said, if you just had a carbonyl there, and if this was a carbon, not a nitrogen, then this really would be a single bond and there really would be free rotation. Yeah. Okay. So we say, we've got the Bloch equations that we could write down. And I'll just write them down for the X and Y components. The Z component will look exactly the same. I give it to you in a notebook, and nothing very interesting. So if I only had the A species, the Bloch equations would look like this. It says, if I have a vector in the xy plane, then it rotates in the xy plane. And it rotates in the xy plane, of course, here, because we say that there's a Hamiltonian that is omega A sigma z over 2, right? And so there's a rotation in of the spins. And you know, that would be dependent upon the chemistry and the applied magnetic field, but we'll just treat it as a Hamiltonian. And there would be these terms that says the system relaxes to zero in the xy plane, because of course this is the sum total of the Hamiltonian, so the energy is only along the z direction. So there can't be an equilibrium state with population in x and y, because there's no energy, there's no preferred direction in x and y. So that better get to zero, yeah? So that's the Bloch equations that says, I just have the A spin, but I don't just, and we'll write the same ones for the B spin. But it says, no, I don't have just the A spin. that if I have the A spin, there's some rate at which it's converted to the B spin, the rate at which it jumps. And if I have the B spin, there's some rate at which it's converted to the A spin. And so we add that in. It says, oh yes, with some rate, this thing, I lose the coherence here because it's going to the B spin. And I gain some from the B spin. And these two rates of course don't depend upon the state. And then we add in the exactly equivalent ones for the B spin, so Y. So omega B sigma Y negative omega B M sub X, and it's minus K B A MXB plus K A B MXA minus MXB divided by 2B. Okay. It's too big a matrix. But it really is easy to solve, okay? So let's ask the question. If I look at the spectra of this, if I said that all the k's are equal to zero, and if I say that this is omega A and this is omega B, and we ask, what do we see as a function of time? Well, it's easy. We see A and B rotating as a function of time. So if I looked at the expectation value of mx of A as a function of time, it would oscillate. With a frequency given by omega A, so that the periodicity, of course, is 1 over that, and it would decay with a time constant of T2A, right? And so I can think about solving these, one, by looking at the time evolution of the magnetization, or I can take the Fourier transform of this. If I had the Fourier transform of a sinusoidal signal with an exponential decay, then I get to Lorentzian line shape, and I see those two pieces. So now, let's go ahead. And look at this. And the reason that I wanted to spend a little bit of time on this exchange piece is that with a lot of the dynamics we studied, whether it's this singlet with two spin 1/2, two spin 1 case, or looking at refocusing effects, which we'll talk about, or looking at the rotating wave approximation, which we'll talk about tomorrow, anytime we have some dynamics, we can always put it into these terms. And so if you understand what happens generically, well, then you'll understand how to apply it to other systems. So all I do here is have a program that doesn't run. All I do is define the block equations exactly as I've defined them for you there, and I solve them. And then we look at, in this case, the time dependence of m sub x as a function of the exchange parameters. And I've made the problem a little bit simpler by saying that these two are equal to each other and equal to k. So that effectively says that the populations of A and B are the same. Okay? And it gives me just one parameter to play with. And I've taken omega A is equal to minus omega B. All right? So we have these two that are centered right about zero. Okay. So now I'm looking at this oscillation, and I turn up this exchange constant. I allow them to exchange. What's going to happen to that? Life is good. So they increase this. We see that the line broadens and it goes to the average, which is zero. Okay? Now that I hope is nice. You say, oh yes, what's going to happen is that because I'm exchanging information, eventually they need to end up here, right? Because I'm removing this frequency difference by allowing these two to swap back and forth. So eventually they better end up here. But as they swap slowly, I allow them to evolve for some time. But remember that this is just a random jump, right? That's just a probability that the system jumps. And so there's a random phase that's associated. And so the lines first get broad. So there's a time dependence. And we'll come back to that in a second. But let's come down here and look at the spectrum. And if I look at the spectrum and I increase the exchange rate, you see that what happens is that initially the two lines don't change position, they change width. Okay? And as they become broader and broader and broader, you start to see at some point that they fill in the middle. Okay. Now what happens if I make the exchange faster now? So we've got a line here, says it's zero frequency, right? There's no frequency component in there. What happens if I exchange things even faster?
So
first they become one. And then what's going to happen is if you exchange things very fast, they'll never know that in fact there were two species. Right? If I exchange things so fast, so that, which says that k times omega a is the rate. I want k divided by omega a divided by k. When this thing becomes one, then they're going to start to no longer know that there ever was two lines. And so the line is going to get sharper. So we return coherence. And we make the system more and more coherent. And if I look at it in this picture, if I increase k, then we get a nice and sharp line at the zero peak. Okay? And in this plot, I've included changes in the width, in the separation of those, just because if I make them closer, then of course they coalesce sooner, right? They come together faster. That's not surprising. The slower it is, the more they come together. The later they come together. Okay. So what I want you to get out of this is a couple of things. One, the general dynamics, that if you're looking at an exchange, then I'm saying, hey, we have some process, and I could think about what the effective Hamiltonian is over the process. What's the effective Hamiltonian? Well, the effective Hamiltonian would be some averaging of these frequencies. And it would be some averaging of these rates, right? By exchanging those two particles, if I exchange them slowly, they still look like two particles. And I better keep all the complexity. As I exchange it faster and faster and faster, it becomes one effective average particle, right? That loses all of the details of the structure that we had. And all of this piece of it goes away, right? The only thing that we're left with is this simple relaxation picture. Yeah? They have the feeling that I haven't quite convinced you. Some question would be reassuring.
Why does solution go through the first time?
So the reason in this particular example that this thing goes to zero is that I set those two to be the negative of each other. If I hadn't done that, then let me see if I can. Then under fast exchange, we would have a term that says, hey, there's only one bit. It goes to and I need to define that 1 over T2AB is equal to 1 over T2A plus 1 over T2B. Right? You have to average the rates, not the times. And so goes to only the average properties of those. The exchange piece doesn't enter in at all, right? If you have fast exchange, then it doesn't matter anymore what the time constant of the exchange is. It says, oh yeah, no, it's just fast. And we see that we return the coherence to the system. In the slow exchange process, we get this very broadened line that has very little coherence because we've introduced a mechanism for having a random phase. Exchange introduces a random phase, and so we get these broad lines that comes out from the random phase due to the exchange process. Then we make it
faster and faster and faster, and we get a nice sharp peak. Other questions? Okay. That was just an insert, but we'll use it. And if you, I guess no one's seen it before. How many people have seen the rotating wave approximation? No. Okay. So we'll use it directly tomorrow to talk about the rotating wave approximation. And so we'll see it all again in the system. And what I had meant to do right now was to show you an experiment with the NB, to go back to the NB and show you an experiment that allows us to use the electron spin as a probe of the nuclear spin. And let me outline it. And then afterwards, we'll go over it again. So we have the electron in the system. And somewhere close by is a C13. I'm going to describe the couplings and the Hamiltonians of this very well to you later on, because I hope it'll be very well. But now, let's just talk about a quantum circuit. So the electron spin, I can polarize, I can prepare in any state I like. I can do that with really high fidelity. So let's just do that. We'll take a state, alpha 0 plus beta 1. So some arbitrary state of the electron. And then I'm going to tensor that with the 0 state of the C13. And I can prepare that really, really well, too. Now, I apply a control NOT gate. And the control is going to flip the carbon spin dependent upon the electron spin. So we end up with the state we often end up with these things, right? So it's a potentially entangled state depending on our choice of alpha and beta. Okay. Now, I measure the electron. What's the state after I measure the electron?
It depends on the altitude.
I like that answer. Okay, so let's say I get 0. What's the state?
Then it's
0. Well, let's say I get 1. Then it's 1. And the probabilities are?
Alpha squared.
Good. So here we end up saying that we have 0 or 1 on the carbon spin. Now remember that when I measure the electron spin, we are turning on the light. We're counting the photons. So if I measure the electron spin, eventually it always ends up in the zero manifold. Right? So it says, oh yes, the electron spin is going to be 0 for both of those. Yeah? No choice. We turn on the light. We go back down somewhere up there. We always end up in the zero manifold. Okay. Now then, I take this state and I apply a controlled knot to it. And I apply a controlled knot to rotate the electron spin. Okay? So I'm going to rotate the electron spin conditionally on the nuclear spin. So now I end up in the zero, zero state. Or the 1-1 state. Absolutely no entanglement, right? That's okay. Now I measure the electron spin. Okay? And if I got 0 here, I'm going to get 0 again, right? So if I make a measurement, I'm going to go this way, but we'll get out some more photons. right? And if I measured it here, hey, we'll go back to that state, but I'll get out some more photons. And what limits how many times I can go through that loop? Does it depend upon the electron at all? Right, yeah, it doesn't, because we could keep putting the electron back to zero state. So it's completely independent of the electron property. What property of the nuclear spin does it depend upon?
How stable
spin. Yes. So good. So it says, how long does it live in the energy basis? Right? So that's actually not a coherence time, it's a lifetime. So it depends upon the T1 of the nuclear spin, which is really long. It can be as long as hours or days in some systems. It takes us 3 microseconds to get to make a measurement. So we can measure it lots and lots and lots and lots of times. And we can build up good statistics. And so we can extend the measurement operator over and over and over and over and over again. Now, looking at it like this, if I just did this experiment, starting off here once, and then I make 1,000,000 measurements down here, do I measure an expectation value? Why don't we leave that for your tutorial? Yeah? So, of course, we would like to say, yeah, that if we make a measurement of 1,000,000 times, that we would measure some expectation value. I guess the question is, do we measure an expectation value that is useful for characterizing that state? And if we don't, how should we do it? Yeah? Okay, so we'll stop here, continue next tomorrow, and we'll look at the rotating wave approximation. So one more piece of physics that you need in your toolbox of physics, and then we'll get back to the Hamiltonians of the NV system and show you that in some detail. On Friday, unfortunately, I'll remind you that I'm not going to be here. So you don't have to wake up quite so early. And we'll replace that lecture Monday at 2. Is that going to work?
Hopefully.
Okay. So we're going to try to do that and see. And there was some question about the pictures showing up in these notebooks.
Yeah.
And that's if you're looking at the NB files. So if you're looking at the Mathematica files and you're not using a Mac, then the pictures that I imported to them won't show up. But then in the CDF files, they should show up on all platforms. Is that true or not?
I don't think so.
No?
Neither.
Okay. Then you should all be using Macs. I'll give you a PDF. Of those, it says, so you'll have 3 versions of each of the notes, and there you'll see the figures. Thanks.